We've been going through a red letter study, and for the new faces here, the people that are here for the first time, that means going through the words of Jesus throughout the New Testament. And we've been doing it in a harmonized way in terms of going through all four Gospels and pulling in the relevant material so that we're getting, you know, pretty much all the details there as much as we can as we move through. And for the past couple of months, we've been right in the Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And so, in this case, staying right inside Matthew for the most part. But the sermon itself is the distillation of all of Jesus' teaching. If you can get the sermon, you can basically get everything else that he's talking about. It's all right here, and the rest is amplification and more images and stories and ways to really bring this thing down. And really, that's what Jesus is doing. He's got one message. One message he's trying to get across. But it's such a difficult message. This notion of being born again, that we sometimes just in the media, in our culture, just sort of blithely sort of paper over and say, okay, yes, you know, we're born again now. We have a personal relationship. But what does that really mean? And if it hasn't changed our basic attitudes toward life, if it hasn't changed the way we decide and choose, then how can we say that we've really been born again? Even if we've gone through some sort of religious ritual, even if we speak in tongues, you know, what is it that changes us fundamentally from the inside out? That's what Jesus is after. And the problem is the way that we go about doing that is not like anything else that we do in life. The way that we go about obtaining things, acquiring things in life is absolutely diametrically 180 degrees opposed with the way that we need to go about this way of kingdom that Jesus is trying to get across to us. And the biggest problem is this notion that we have to go out and acquire something. That's the problem. What Jesus is telling us in this absolute statement of the good news is that we already have everything that we need in order to be completely fulfilled as a human being in God. There's nothing to go out and get. You know, it's like Dorothy at the end of The Wizard of Oz saying, next time I go after my heart's desire, I won't look any further than my own backyard. Because if it's not there, I never really lost it to begin with. It's the same idea here. Jesus is saying that the kingdom is not out there to be observed. It's within. It's among. It's in the midst. That is the fundamental difference, but it is so difficult for us as human beings to understand that. We always want to go out and do something in order to fill in the blank. Be good enough, smart enough, pretty enough, employed enough. We do all these things in order to be accepted. And we use the things of religion and even ethics and morality and law as the standards by which we go out and try to be good enough to acquire the things that we think we need. And it just makes us nuts. And it exacerbates the problem because the more we try in that direction, the further we get from what Jesus is talking about in terms of the quality of life that we can have right here and right now. If we will simply let ourselves be present to the moment, present to God's Spirit, which we can only access in this moment here and now, only. And so there's this conundrum. And he basically spends the entire New Testament trying to get across to us that we have to completely turn things around. Have any of you ever painted by numbers? Anybody ever paint by numbers? Okay, got a few of you. I know maybe it's sort of a... Are kids doing that anymore? Is that sort of a lost thing? Baby boomers and it just sort of died out? Maybe it's a blessing that it did because... you know, for those of you... Does anyone not know what paint by numbers is? Okay, everybody at least knows what it is. So you got some sort of painting and somebody reduces it to lines and numbers and colors and you just, you know, match the number to the color and fill it in and fill in all the blanks and stay within the lines. And then eventually if you stand far enough back, you've got an approximation. My sister did a paint by numbers of Da Vinci's Last Supper. Yeah. And, you know, so it was a pretty big thing, you know, big old Last Supper thing. And my mom had it hanging on the wall for a couple decades or something like that. Now, I want you to think about, for a second, what was the difference in the process between what my sister went through painting the Last Supper by numbers, and the process Da Vinci went through painting it as an original piece of art. And just think about that for a second. What side of the brain is being used? What type of thought processes are going on? When you're painting by numbers, you're looking at instructions, you're looking at this outline grid with all these numbers, and it's all kind of dizzying and complex and confusing, and you're trying to make sense of it all. And you're painting one little odd shape at a time, and you're finding the colors and putting it here and putting it there. You know, Da Vinci has a concept in mind, an inspiration that he wants to capture. And he closes his eyes probably and imagines the scene in his head. He can step inside. He can see it. He's walking among all the people in the table. He's in that 3D space. I mean, how does any artist conceptualize what they produce, especially when it's as brilliant as a Da Vinci or any of the masters? In his head, he's there. He sees it. He feels it. The colors, the textures, the relationships between each of the characters. And then he goes about his task of his craft. But he's mixing his own colors, sometimes creating his own paints out of powders and pigments and mixing each shade exactly the way he wants it. He's seeing whole figures. He's seeing whole scenes in his mind. And that's what's coming out onto the canvas. Completely different processes. So completely different. And they produce a different result. One is the approximation of the other, but only if you stand way far back, you know, and you kind of let the colors sort of merge together. This is what Jesus is trying to get across to us. See, what we keep trying to do as human beings is we keep trying to live by numbers. We try to live our lives as if painting by numbers. Like if we can just put this here and that there and cobble this together, keep this rule, this ethic, this moral code, you know, show up on Sundays for church and tithe. If I do all of these things, somehow that's going to come out to a life that looks like kingdom. But it doesn't work. Because the actual process is like Da Vinci. It's moving into a space. It's feeling the relationships. It's understanding what really is going on. That in the presence of our God, the things that are important, this connection and relationship, this literal identification with each other, is something that we can't put together by the numbers. We said so many times in here that the means we use must match the ends that we seek. We can't start with a paint-by-numbers concept and get over to this masterpiece of kingdom. And this is what Jesus is trying to get across to us. Way back in Matthew 5:20, and it's been a long time since we've been in Matthew 5, but way back in Matthew 5:20, he gives what I believe is the topic sentence for the entire Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5:20, it's our password here. Now you all know that, because it's such a central piece of scripture to me, you know? Unless you exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will in no way enter the kingdom of heaven. And what was the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees? It was a paint-by-numbers mentality. It was a live-by-law mentality. As if you could keep these 613 written laws and all the thousands of oral laws that were written around that, added around that, if somehow you kept that perfectly and you lived your life with all these little pieces in place, that you were acceptable, at least to them, if not to Father in heaven. And so, making that turn, Jesus is saying, you have to do this. And the people's minds are exploding because they said, how can we in any way be more righteous than the scribes and the Pharisees? But it's a different quality. It's stepping completely aside from that notion and over to something else. And everything that Jesus is doing in the rest of the sermon is backing that up, giving us illustrations, giving us examples of how this works. In the next verse, Matthew 5:21, he talks about murder. And he says, you think you're safe because you didn't kill somebody. But I'm telling you, even if you have an angry thought, you're already guilty. You think you're safe because you haven't committed adultery. But even if you have just that notion of lust, you've already committed adultery in your heart. What's he trying to tell us? That it's about the quality of the relationship that matters. You start there first. It's the broken relationship that leads to murder, adultery, and all the different things that we end up practicing. But don't worry about just not practicing those things. I mean, under the law, yeah, you're going to have to do that. But the goal here is something else. The goal is to turn that around, go inside, change the nature of the relationship. And then everything changes downstream. He tells us to love the enemy a little bit later, right? But what he's telling us here, when he tells us, it's easy to love someone who loves you, but how about loving the enemy? What he's saying is that the behavior of this person is not the standard by which we accept them or not. It's not about behavior. And this is something that is bedrock, that is so difficult for us to get. God's love is not based on our behavior. It is not based on our behavior. And if you're waiting for the lightning bolt to come down and strike me dead, you know, let me just try to explain this for a second. Our behavior has nothing to do with God's love for us. It is absolute. It cannot be altered because God is love. He doesn't practice it. He doesn't withhold it. He is love. But because even though our behavior has nothing to do with God's love, it has everything to do with how we experience God's love here and now. You get the difference? Jesus is always talking about certain behavior that'll bring us into kingdom or kick us out. And we think the kingdom is heaven. So we think our behavior is related to God's ultimate acceptance of us. The kingdom is not heaven of the next life. Kingdom is the quality of life here and now in awareness and identification with God's Spirit. And our behavior has everything to do with that. But if we don't start practicing that another person's behavior does not impinge upon our ability to love them, to care for them, to treat them as a fellow human being, we will never understand how we are loved by our God. It's not about behavior. It's about identification. Jesus is trying to get us to make that shift. It's not about behavior and obedience and the fear of punishment. That's the paint-by-numbers concept, right? It's about transformation. It's about identification. It's about relationship. It's about love, making that shift. He goes further at Matthew 7, and he says about charity, giving to the poor, fasting, and praying, the three marks of righteousness in the rabbinical system. He says it's not about practicing righteousness. It's not about practicing these types of behavior. The righteousness is not in the behavior. It's in secret. It's in silence. It's in solitude. Take those things out of the public arena and bring them back into your closet. Because what happens in silence? What happens in solitude? As long as we keep our lives noisy enough, busy enough, active enough, we have places to hide. But you let yourself get silent. You let yourself be alone for a moment with the Spirit of God. And there's no place to hide. Who you really are comes out. That's the 2:30 in the morning staring at the ceiling syndrome, right? Everything's off. No place to hide. All the stuff comes out at that point. Jesus says, take your righteousness into your closet. Take it into the silence. Then you will find the identification with truth, not identification with forms of behavior that mean nothing in and of themselves. Then he talks about judgment. Judgment at the top of Matthew 7. Actually, I think charity and fasting was the top of 7. It's actually the top of 6. Judgment is at the top of 7. And he's trying to get us to understand is that when we judge someone against a standard, again, we're separating ourselves from them. We are deeming them unworthy of us. We're deeming them other than us, less than us. And then from there, he moves on to the story about stones and snakes, right? If your son asks you for a loaf of bread, will you give him a stone? And if he asks for a fish, will you give him a snake? And what he's trying to do is telling us, yes, we're not supposed to judge, because if we judge, we have separated ourselves and created that standard on ourselves, but we need to discern things. And how do we discern them? We discern two things that look alike. In that culture, the loaf of bread and the smooth round stones that were common in Judea looked alike from a distance, but one could give life and one could not. So he's saying you need to look at these things and discern between the two, which brings life and which does not. Because remember, you got two paintings here. They look similar. One was painted by Numbers and one was painted by the Master. From a distance, they look similar. But they're worlds apart. Can we start to discern between the two? That's not judgment that separates. That is discernment that guides us to the place where we need to go. You see how everything that Jesus is talking about in the sermon is leading us in the same direction? Then he comes to the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's a statement of identification in action. It's as if everything that you did to another was doing it to yourself and vice versa. Because you are so identified with the other, you've crossed that boundary to the other, that doing something to them is as if you did it to yourself. And so he has led us from that topic sentence, Matthew 5:20, exceeding the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, exceeding the paint by numbers concept, and then illustrates it beautifully all the way down. And now we get to the target verse for today. And it's right in there. Matthew 7:13 and 14. I want you to follow along if you've got your Bibles open up. TJ's got them on the screens, I bet, by now, because he's always right on it. And they're also in the bulletins. Enter through the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction. And there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life. And there are few who find it. So, given what we've just talked about, do you see how this verse is an illustration or an amplification of this transformation, this born-againness that Jesus is talking about? No. He's trying to take us from behavior to identification. You know, he's trying to get us to see that there's a difference. So, this way that leads to life, there's something constricted about it. There's something difficult about it. There's something that few people really will be willing to do. All right? And the way that is broad, that people are traveling in droves, is not leading to the life that Jesus is trying to get us. He's trying to get us again to discern between these two things, to get us where we need to go. But what happens immediately when we read this as modern Western Christians, the image that Jesus uses and the language he uses leads to a difficulty. You know, and what's the difficulty? Well, the question is begged, where are these gates and where are these ways leading? Now, for us, steeped in 2,000 years of Western Christianity and especially 500 years of Protestant Reformation, we believe that these gates and these ways are leading to heaven of the afterlife. Take a look at that picture down there at the bottom. I put this image in there because it's a typical image of trying to illustrate this, right? So you got this broad path with all these little ant-like guys following down like lemmings and falling over the edge of a cliff. I know it's only black and white, but there's fiery, lava-like evil stuff down there. And there they go over the edge, right? And here you have this narrow way, and of course it's shaped like a cross, and I only see two little ant-like figures actually going that way, and it's going off into the light. And so this is the automatic image that we end up with when we start thinking about this particular passage. And we're right back to obedience, right back to the law, right back to painting by numbers if we think this way. That there is only this little way. And further, what does that do to our concept of God if that's what we really believe? The way to life, the way to heaven is narrow and few go by it. Does that mean that God created the mass quantities of the human race simply as fodder for hell? That most of the people he created was to burn in hell for eternity? Is that this God? I mean, think about that for a second. I mean, everybody look to the person on your right. Look to the person on your left. If they're not the ones going to hell, then guess who it is? Daryl just sat next to Frank and saved him, he thinks. You know, when I say it that way, we're all laughing and it sounds absurd. But I tell you what, in our heart of hearts, that's what we're thinking. I'm telling you, growing up as a little Catholic, it was beat into me until you nearly wanted to pee your pants, how scared you could get going into confession, coming out of confession, waiting for confession. Because if you die now, what's going to happen? Well, I'm not on the narrow way. I'm on some other way. You know, we do this to ourselves. In classic Calvinism, it gets so absurd. And yet, you know, Calvinists have followed this. Thank God they're not following classic Calvinism much anymore. But for those of you who don't know about classic Calvinism, it's usually summarized by the acronym TULIP, T-U-L-I-P. And the T stands for total depravity, which means that we are born totally depraved. We are born completely lost, completely out of connection with God, and there's absolutely nothing that we can do about it. We are just stuff on the bottom of God's shoe, and there's no way to redeem ourselves. Completely and totally depraved. The U stands for unconditional election, which means that God as a sovereign power decides unconditionally who's going to be saved and who's not. And again, you have nothing to do about it. This is the idea of predestination. You know, unconditional election. The ones who are going to be saved are elected unconditionally by God, unilaterally, without anything to say. L is limited atonement. This means that even Jesus' death on the cross only applies to those who are already unconditionally elected and to nobody else. Now, if you're a classic Calvinist, are you going to evangelize? What's the point? Why would you do it? You can't change this thing. God already said it from the beginning of time. Who's in, who's out, who's going to hell, who's going to heaven. The I is irresistible grace. That means the action of the Holy Spirit, the grace of God, is irresistible for those who have been unconditionally elected. Has no effect on anybody else. But if you have been predetermined to be saved, you will be irresistibly drawn to your salvation, whether you like it or not. Kicking and screaming, I suppose. Kind of like an intervention. I don't know. And then the L is limited atonement. I'm sorry, but P, perseverance of the saints. That's the once saved, always saved. So once you have been irresistibly drawn, then you're saved and you can't lose it. It's a weird way of looking at life. But in modified forms, to one degree or another, we in Western Christianity have believed all or part of that. We really believe that God created most of the people on earth to go to hell. And what kind of monstrous God would do that? And how do we trust such a God? And is that really what's going on here? You know, our common sense would tell us no. But can we use common sense when it comes to God? Because God's ways are not our ways. And God works in mysterious ways. And he's holy and we're not. And he's omniscient and we're not. And who are we to question him? So can we even use some of the things that we might be feeling right now and some things that we're chuckling about in the face of God? Or are we just supposed to take it the way it's delivered to us? I think Jesus gives us the permission to use our common sense with his Father. He tells us, and he told us just a few verses before. He said, if you who are evil, you who are imperfect, you who are falling down all over yourself and doing the best that you can, know how to give good things to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good things to you for those of you who ask him? That's common sense. That's logical reasoning. Applying the things that we can understand in this life to his Father in heaven. Isn't he doing that? Doesn't that give us permission to do that as well? Would we ever, as parents, make 3/4 of our kids to go to hell and only one to go to heaven? If it were in our power to do so, why in the world would we ever do that? We love our children. And in 1 Timothy, Paul tells us that God desires that everyone be reconciled to him, every single one. There is something wrong with the way we're thinking about this. And once again, it's all about context. We think the context of all of Jesus' teaching and maybe all of the New Testament is about heaven and hell because we're fixated on salvation in the next life, the avoidance of hell and the admission to heaven. But all of the context of Jesus' teaching is about kingdom. And kingdom is not about heaven and hell. Kingdom is about here and now. Salvation to a Jew is spiritual liberation here and now. Jesus is talking as a Jew to Jews in their language and not redefining these terms. What they believe about salvation is okay with him, unless he redefines it. He spent all his time redefining kingdom because he knew they had the wrong idea, but he let salvation stand. See, what Jesus is trying to do is to put everything in the here and now. And when it comes to the here and now, yes, there are many people, most people, do not ever avail themselves of the life that is possible here and now. Very few ever do. Most of us are sleepy walking. Most of us are... I like that, actually. That's pretty good. Sleepy walking. Okay. Sleepy walking, jabber walking, I don't know what we're doing. But we're not present to our lives here. We're not here. We're going through the motions. We're phoning it in. We're just acting on the programming of the past, those programs for happiness that we talked about, emotional programs for happiness. We're not driving the car. Jesus is trying to wake us up. He's trying to say, look, most of you are not here. You're not full. You're not awake. Wake up. Something really different can happen here. If we could just do this, if we can get here. And so the questions I suppose that we need to ask ourselves, if we can start to really understand how we can use a verse like this, and this is of ultimate importance to me. I never want to just sit here and discuss how many angels can dance on the head of a pin with you. That's not my point. Theology for its own sake is just, it's worse than useless. It gets in the way of what we're trying to do. But theology that can be applied, and this is not really theology, this is an image that can be applied directly to the moments of our lives, that's something different. That we can use. That we can use as soon as we go out that door to make a different decision, to start to change our attitudes towards life, to move toward this born-again transformative experience that Jesus is drawing us toward. And so the first question, I think there's five questions, and we'll go through them quickly. The first one is, what is this gate? What is the gate? If we don't know what the gate is, then how in the world are we going to negotiate the gate? Because we've got to negotiate the gate first before we can walk the way, right? So what is it about this gate? Fortunately, Jesus tells us. John 10:1-9. Truly I say to you, he who does not enter by the door, he who does not enter by the gate into the fold of the sheep, but climbs up some other way, he is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door, he who enters by the gate, and that word there, both in Aramaic and Greek, can be either one. Here it's translated as door in the NASB. Other places it's translated as gate. He who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. Truly I say to you, I am the gate. I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the gate. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved. Spiritual liberation here, going out into pasture and being able to find food and sustenance, and he will go in and out and find that pasture. Jesus is the gate. Now, if you know anything about ancient sheepfolds, and I only know the concept, I've never actually seen one, but in the ancient world, what they would typically do is against usually a cliff or a hillside, they would just build out three walls, short walls. They didn't have to be very high, because sheep are not known for their intelligence, okay? You know, they see a little obstruction and they will obey it. They'll stay there. So they only had to do is just, you know, build up rocks or anything that they could find just around three sides, and they would leave a space. And normally they didn't have any materials to actually build a functioning gate. So what would the shepherd do? Just lie down and sleep in the opening. Drive the sheep into the enclosure at the end of the day and lie down, literally becoming the gate. Jesus is using an image here that all of them understood. They had this image. They knew what that meant. I am the door of the sheepfold. I am the gate. But here's what he's also trying to get across, that anyone who goes through any other way has an ulterior motive. They're taking a shortcut. And shortcuts don't work. They do not work. Painting by numbers, living by numbers, is a shortcut. It doesn't work. We can't use the law. We can't use ethics and morality. We can't use our religious practice to get us to where Jesus is trying to get us. It doesn't work. Shortcuts don't work. We understand how cheating is a shortcut to trying to get a good grade on a test. We understand how stealing is a shortcut to trying to get wealth that we haven't earned. We understand those kind of shortcuts. Sex and drugs, also shortcuts to try to find what? Relationship? Try to find some sort of peace? They don't work. They have side effects that we don't want to live through. But there are socially acceptable shortcuts as well. And we don't see how damaging those are. We think our religious practice is a good thing, you know? And it is, if it's used in conjunction with what Jesus is talking about. But if we're using it as a shortcut, if we're using it instead of putting ourselves into this relationship, this awareness, this place of connection, then it's not going to work. It will not work. And Jesus is trying to get this across to us in the most clear language that he possibly can. Righteous behavior, lawful behavior, religion, everything we do to try to get ourselves in good with God misses the point so completely that it becomes an obstacle to us. The only door, the only way is through Jesus. And I guess I gave away the next one, didn't I? John 14, 1-6. Do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you. For I go to prepare a place for you. I go and prepare a place. I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way where I'm going. But Thomas says to him, Lord, we don't know where you're going. How do we know the way? And Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. And no one comes to the Father but through me. Jesus is the gate. Jesus is the way. And then what do? We use this particular scripture to set an exclusivity on Christianity, don't we? Jesus is the only way. Unless I understand Jesus the way a Western Christian does, not only a Western Christian, unless I understand Jesus the way a Catholic does, the way a Baptist does, you know, choose your denomination, choose your flavor. Unless you understand Jesus the way I do, then you're still going to hell. Because Jesus is the only way. We turn it into an intellectual proposition. I remember when I first landed in an evangelical church, I was told that Mormons were going to hell because they follow a different Jesus. Now, I had spent a year in the Mormon church, and I'm telling you, there are Mormons there who are much more Christ-like than many of the evangelicals I've met. But then again, behavior has nothing to do with God's love, does it? But we keep forgetting that, don't we? Yeah. So when Jesus says, I am the way and no one comes to the Father but through me, what is he talking about? He's talking about a way of living life that brings us into contact with our Father. He's not talking about heaven and hell. He's talking about kingdom right here, right now. Live the way Jesus lives. Love the way Jesus loved. Relate the way he related. And he said, you will know the truth and the truth will make you free. Free of the fear. Free of the need to paint by numbers, you know, free of all the dysfunctional, obsessive, compulsive behavior that we think we need to do just to make ourselves acceptable, get through another 24 hours. Jesus is the gate and Jesus is the way. So that begs the third question. Who is this Jesus? Who is he? He answered that question himself most profoundly and most clearly when he simply said, I and the Father are one. Philip says, show us the Father and that will be enough for us. Philip, you've seen me. You've lived with me all these years and you still don't understand. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. There's nothing that I do that the Father doesn't do through me. There's nothing that hasn't already been done by the Father that I do. There's no daylight between us. We are completely identified. There is no difference between us. I and the Father are one. So what does that mean? If Jesus and the Father are one, and Jesus is the gate, and Jesus is the way, then the Father is the gate, and the Father is the way. And the deepest purpose, the will, the sevyana, the pleasure and the delight and the desire of the Father in heaven is Jesus as well. And it's imbued in gate and way. When we enter into that deepest purpose, when we are as pleasure filled as God is in connection, in relationship, in freely giving as we have freely received, that's kingdom. It's the only way. You can't shortcut it. You can't obey your way into it. You need to, from the inside out, be transformed by it. The next question that I would ask is, then why is this way so narrow? Why are so few going by this way? The answer is just written in our human nature. You know, it is so difficult for us to leave what is familiar for something that is unfamiliar. It is so difficult for us to leave the safety of what is seen, what we understand, for something that is unseen and mysterious. It is so difficult for us to leave the notion of an outcome that we are geared toward and working for and striving for, and just let the outcome go and live our moments and let the outcomes fend for themselves. That's risky. That's scary. Few people live that way. How many people do you know that really live that way? That really can take each moment as it comes? That don't spend the majority of their time worrying and obsessing and anxious? You want to know how you're doing on this way? Measure your stress level. That'll tell you all you need to know. Did you know that trust and stress are inversely proportional? As one goes up, the other goes down. As your trust goes up, your stress and your anxiety and your worry go down, and vice versa. So yeah, our pendulum is always swinging. But can we say that we're characterized by trust, characterized by contentment, characterized by kingdom? Be honest with yourself. If not, then you're still painting by numbers. And there's something that Jesus is trying to get you to see, deeply see, that there's another way to live life. We need a pioneer spirit if we're going to do this thing. We need to be willing to blaze our own trails and not just follow the ones that are already there for us. Because the ones that are familiar are probably not the ones that we need to take. Even if they worked for somebody else when they first blazed it, it's not ours. We need to blaze our own trail. It needs to be our own journey. We can't receive it from anybody else. Our faith can never be secondhand. It can never be hearsay. It must be first person, or it's nothing at all. Because anything that we have acquired in the paint-by-numbers scenario will not sustain us when the storms of life come. When life mugs us, it's not going to work. And Jesus knows this, and he's trying to get us, but it's so difficult. Very few people wake up in their moments and try to live the way Jesus is asking us to live, because it's never passive, always active, always engaging. It's a different way of living life entirely. So, next question, last question. How do we begin to negotiate this narrow way? How do we do it? Where do we go? And I think there are clues here in the Aramaic that are going to help us to understand. This narrow gate, the word there, it's translated narrow both times in many translations, but it's two different words in Aramaic. Narrow, when it's used with the gate, is katina. And katina literally means thin. It means frail. And this one I like, subtle. It's subtle. It's delicate. It's ethereal. Not a lot of substance to it. You know, something that could easily be missed. Thin and frail and subtle. Narrow, when it's used with way, is alisa. And that can mean compelling. It can mean pressing. And it can mean to make urgent. Interesting, huh? Compelling and pressing and urgent. The gate, the tara, it's a door, it's a gate, but at its roots, it means to flow or to open between worlds or open and flow over boundaries. I love that one. It's the opening to flow over a boundary. And in this case, the boundaries that exist between us and another person, between us and God. Those hard boundaries that we think we see, and especially when we're painting by numbers, everything is a boundary, right? You're staying within your boundary. What happens if you flow over the boundaries? You don't color inside the lines anymore. Well, the paint-by-numbers painting is ruined. It's never going to be what we imagined the outcome to be. It could be something much better, but it won't be what we imagined it to be. To be able to flow over those boundaries is what the idea of this door, this gate, is all about. And finally, the way, the urha, is a path, but it's also a manner of living. So if you take a look at this last piece, and TJ won't be able to put it up. If you have it, if you have your bulletins, take a look or just listen. This is an Aramaic paraphrase. using those definitions, and this is only Matthew 7:14, subtle and delicate is the gate that lets us flow over our boundaries. Compelling and urgent is the way that leads to the connectedness of all. It is not a way for the faint-hearted, for those unwilling to use their full inner fire and passionate desire to find it. How does that change things for you? This isn't about a surefire way to get into heaven and avoid hell. This is about flowing over boundaries. And to drive that point home, look above it. The Messages version, another paraphrase from Eugene Peterson. Don't look for shortcuts to God. The market is flooded with surefire, easygoing formulas for a successful life that can be practiced in your spare time. The paint-by-numbers, right? Don't fall for that stuff, even though crowds of people do. The way to life, to God, is vigorous and requires total attention. I like that too. Are you starting to see the difference here? What Jesus is trying to get across is everything. It's everything about the way that we approach life. It's matching the means to the ends that we seek. It's becoming involved in our moments. Before we can walk the way, we have to negotiate the gate. And the gate is subtle, it's thin, and it's frail. In other words, it's like nothing that we would expect. What do you imagine the gates to be? The gates that lead to the way to life. Do you think of all those jokes about someone coming before the pearly gates and meeting Peter? Do you have in your mind images from the book of Revelation or Daniel or Ezekiel of all these tessellated things and sapphires and rubies and crystal floors and great thrones? Is that what you imagine about the gate? If so, what happens when you really come upon it and it's thin and it's frail and it's subtle? And it's kind of overgrown with foliage. You walk right past it. I think so often many of us would walk right past the gate of the kingdom in search of the lights of Las Vegas, because that's what we imagine it to look like. Bright and shiny and huge and spectacular. But guess what? Jesus was thin and frail, unassuming, meek, gentle, a servant who would wash his friend's feet. Do you know how shocking that is in that culture? That dirty, horrible job reserved only for slaves, and he is the master washing his friend's feet. Isaiah tells us that there's no attractiveness in him that we would desire him. He's not even attractive? You mean he doesn't look like Tab Hunter or Jake Gyllenhaal? I don't know. Whoever played him, you know, with the piercing blue eyes. Would we walk right past Jesus because he is not the gate that we expect to see? Unless we have become a people prepared to see beneath the surface of things, a people who are sensitized to what is really significant and real, we will walk right past the gate. And if we can't negotiate the gate, we will never walk the way. We can't get there. What Jesus is trying to say. But Jesus is saying here, just like the first step of AA, which is recognizing our powerlessness, right? To recognize that we don't have it all together, that we're imperfect, that we're vulnerable, but that at the same time we're not helpless and we're not a victim, because we have one thing left at our disposal, and that's a choice. And we can make the choice to avail ourselves to a power greater than ourselves, to let go of all the expectations and all the power that we think we have to mold and manipulate and to make outcomes happen, and just see what is right in front of our faces. This little, unassuming gate that we never noticed before and never paid any attention to if we did, that we always walked past in search of the next spectacular thing in our lives. But once we let all that go, let all the air out of our tires, suddenly this gate makes sense. Suddenly it's a path, even if only because we've tried everything else we can think of, we're going to go this way and we're going to see what this holds. And in that moment, the entire world becomes possible to us. In that moment, there is a turning, a transformation. And literally it's as if we were born again into a new reality, into a new expectation. This is what Jesus is trying to do for us. This is where Jesus is trying to get us to go. I wanted to read you one more thing in closing. And this is a poem that I know you've heard bits of, but maybe you've never heard the whole thing. It's by Robert Frost. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry that I could not travel both and be one traveler, long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubt if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. The truth is, it's not one choice that we make for all time. Each and every moment, each and every breath contains a choice. We choose, moment by moment, which road we take, which gate we negotiate. In the end, in the analysis of our lives, it will be stringing together all the moments that we chose kingdom, that we chose Jesus, that we chose gate and way, that will define our lives, that will have transformed us into a people who will see our God, our unassuming, loving, servant God, when he is presented to us, and not walk on by. Let's pray. Father, it's hard for us to imagine who you present yourself to be in our scriptures. You're the King of the universe. You're the creator of everything. You're Alpha and Omega. And yet, you tell us you wash our feet. You tell us you exist to serve us, your creation. It is so hard for us to comprehend that. It's so hard for us to act on that, trust it, and let it begin its work of transforming us. But Father, help us. Help us to understand who you are. Help us to let go of the things that we carry so that we can just be present to you in this moment and see that's who you are. Who you said you are is exactly who you are. Help us to learn to love that enough that we can learn to live it ourselves and take pleasure in the same things you take pleasure in so that we can just live with you and learn to love the moments of our lives. You're an amazing God. Thank you for everything that you give us, Lord. And thank you for loving us as you do, because we can only love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.